Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Worsham. With me today is our resident pediatrician, the one, the only, Dr. Jay Soute. How are you on this fine day, Doc?
Hey. How are you doing, Justin?
I'm fantastic. I'm having a good week so far. Well, let's get into this real quick because you gave me a little preemptive warning that you have a little one at your house right now. Is that fair to say?
Yes, a little 4.5-month-old rescue lab puppy from Mississippi. And I got to tell you, I've always had Connecticut puppies. I've never had one from a red state before, and this one is kind of stupid. You know, they say he's lab and something else. He's lab and a lot of something else. He's like the end result of the movie Idiocracy if it was based on dogs. That's what I'm thinking.
But you say that in the most loving way possible, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, when I got him, he was 20 pounds. He's 35 now, except his head hasn't grown all that much. And I asked the vet if there was some kind of canine Zika outbreak going on in Mississippi that I should be aware of. But no, he's great. His name's Rodney, after the great Rodney Dangerfield. And he pees outside about 82% of the time.
That's awesome. Well, good for you. And I like this because, you know, your daughter's obviously all grown up. And now,
out of the house, it's just me and the dog now.
Yeah. And you have reset. I always find this interesting when, because you said, you're like, oh, this is bullshit.
Yeah, I know. You
wanted a puppy and now you have it. And here you are, a man who has not only raised your own children, but also on the daily is dealing with other people raising their children. And yet you still have the biological ignorance to, like, you know what? Let's get a puppy and start over.
Let's take care of another life form.
Yes, exactly. Well, good for you, buddy. I hope I'm sure you and Ronnie have a great time.
Needless to say, I now have no rugs on the first floor of my home.
Uh-oh.
But we'll see if he can earn back some rugs someday.
That's why we don't have nice things. The first thing I have to talk about with you is, I think it was back in July, August at the latest, our very own Dr. J came to us and said, hey, BT Dubs, the recommendations on when you can introduce peanuts to your baby's diet just changed. And that they actually found out that they believe, or maybe they actually, it's done, they no longer believe, they now know that the reason that there was this uptick in peanut allergies is because they were suggesting that you wait too long to introduce, and that by actually introducing peanuts early on, you could avoid a peanut allergy. And I want to throw some kudos your way, because you told us that this last summer. And
We broke the story.
I work at a news station, and it was just about a month ago that it came down the wire that we were talking about it on the radio, at the radio station in Los Angeles. So
it's interesting. I think it was based on a study that came out of Israel, because I think there is a low incidence of peanut allergies in the population there because they have some kind of a butter spread that has peanut in it that they introduce at a very young age. And then they tried to duplicate that and found introducing the peanuts a little bit earlier, 4 to 6 months, sometimes just a little, like, you know, tiniest amount of peanut butter mixed in with, yogurt or fruit or vegetable, just to give them a little exposure to it at a younger age is supposedly going to decrease the amount of peanut allergies. And if I may point out, that's the exact opposite logic that they used for the last 23 years of my career.
And that's why we have this huge surge, and now we have peanut-free zones at schools and nut-free and all that stuff, and you have this nice internal war of parents who don't have a kid with a peanut allergy who are like, this is bullshit, and then you got the people who do have a kid with a peanut allergy, and like, no, your inability to not put nuts in a lunch is bullshit because it's dangerous for my kid. So,
and if you think about it, when we were younger, pre-EpiPen, these kids with peanut allergies, we didn't hear about them because they died at a young age. So,
oh, wow.
I mean, they did. Without the EpiPen and stuff, I mean, the kids that had – I mean, you saw my girl, didn't you? Poor
yes.
Macaulay Culkin?
Yes.
That was a bee sting, but same thing.
Yeah, so with peanuts. Yeah. So anyway, kudos to you, Dr. J. Thank you for giving our listeners that heads up way before anybody else was getting it. You mentioned already that we're in the throes of winter. It's the, I believe, am I wrong? Is this the flu season, or is there like, this is the second flu season?
Flu season can start like in November and it usually goes through April. But the last couple years, we have not seen much of the flu in November, December. I remember the last 2 years, February and March were the worst months for the flu. And we're just starting to see a trickle, maybe one or two kids out of, 60 kids a day, one or two kids that look like they have the flu. So those numbers are only going to go up for February and March, especially since school's out this way, take away the winter vacation so the kids can get out earlier in June. And let me tell you, the virus cycle depends on a freaking February vacation. Let me tell you. We got to get the kids out of the Gen Pop for a week just to get everybody from stop coughing and sniffling. But
yeah,
again, good for business. I can't complain.
But. Right. But it is a thing. And I found this is that the top reasons parents keep sick children out of school. And I kind of want to lump this all into the same kind of thing. So let's just kind of go through these statistics first. And then I would like to get your opinion as we kind of walk through this. The poll revealed that 75% of parents reported at least one sick day for their child in the past year, with concerns about the child's illness getting worse if they went to school and not wanting the child's classmates to get sick among the most important factors in the decision-making process. So that being saying, well, if they don't get rest if they go to school. And then also there's the added fact of the other children getting sick. Of those two, is there anything that a parent should be more concerned about in your experience?
No, but I can tell you that a lot of parents don't give a crap about getting classmates sick because a number of them will get up in the morning at 7 o'clock. The kid will have a fever of 102. They'll give the kid Tylenol, and when it's down to 99, they bring them to school at 9 o'clock, only to have the temperature rise again at 11 and get a call to come and pick the kid up. But by then, the kid's exposed to classroom. Again, good for business.
Exactly. If that kid just stays home.
But I would say fear of things getting worse and having the kid away from home is probably the number one reason that they keep them home. And that probably makes sense because if it's the beginning of something, they're up all night with a cough and runny nose, they don't get a good night of sleep. It's like torture if they get worse while they're at school.
Yeah, and I feel like these numbers are I don't feel like they're true because the representation that I see, and I'm kind of the a-hole, and I get frustrated with my wife because she's done this a couple of times because I get off work at 10, usually like 11 a.m. at the latest, and so or 11 a.m., 12 p.m. at the latest, I'm sorry. But anyway, my idea being that, you miss an hour and a half of work. If I know the kid's sick, I could cut out as soon as the show's over and do most of the stuff after the show from home, right? So my schedule allows for it. Don't send the kid to school. Just go into work a little bit late because nothing annoys me more than when I get there, especially at the kindergarten pickup, and you see the kid who looks like he has some kind of typhoid Mary, like hacking up a lung tuberculosis. Right. Yep. And I'm just like, oh man, like, don't you know you're fucking up my weekend? And it says 60% of parents said concerns about the illness getting worse were the reason that they kept their kid home. Only 40% indicated not wanting the child's classmates to get sick as a very important factor. Now, I still
can I clarify something? I'm wondering about that first one where the child stays home. The most important reason is whether they might get sicker if they went to school. I'm wondering, though, if they're worried that the virus is going to get sicker or the going to school and not getting rest is going to make them sicker. That's unclear what they're asking there. Are they worried about the child getting sicker, or are they worried about the child getting sicker because of the rigors of having to sit through a school day?
Yeah, well, because my assumption would be that if you're home and at rest, that would be the best policy when you're trying to fend off a virus, right?
Right, right. That's, rest, get fluids, and, take something for your aches and pains, and none of those things get done when they go to school.
Exactly.
So, if you know your kid is sick and it's the first day of it, they're going to get sicker, and if they go to school, it's just going to, knock them down further. That's all.
Among the symptoms likely to prevent parents from sending their child to school, diarrhea, 80% would keep their kid home. 20% of people are sending their kids to school where they could barely control their bowels.
There's also a lot of leeway on what people refer to as diarrhea.
Really?
Because if it's less than five times a day, then it's loose stools. Because to me, diarrhea is, 8 to 10 poops a day, watery, you're having accidents, that kind of stuff. And that can be diet related or viral. I mean, kids who drink a lot of fruit juice, they shit themselves all the time. So, if it's infectious diarrhea, a day of vomiting followed by a couple of days of diarrhea, stay home. If they're having two or three loose stools a day, well, give them some fiber and a little bit of brown rice and, Teddy Grahams and, that kind of stuff will help to firm it up. So it does make a difference where the diarrhea is coming from. If it's dietary, they should go to school. It's nasty, but they're not getting anybody else sick. Hmm. Whereas if it's with a fever and a couple of days of vomiting, those kids should stay home until their fever's gone or their poops are firmed up a bit. I had to clarify because people don't know what diarrhea means. People don't know what lethargic means either. That's what to me, lethargic means close to comatose. So when parents come in and say, "Oh, he was lethargic last night," I said, and he's got a handful of cheese doodles and he's running around the room screaming. That's a word that people use too much also.
See, that's it. No, you're fine. This is exactly what we do this for. That's interesting because it says 80% keep their kid home if they have diarrhea. But what you're actually saying is that if the kid, even if the kid has diarrhea or, say, a loose stool, unless the diarrhea is from some kind of viral infection, but if I understood what you just said, even if it is kind of viral, the chances of them contaminating another kid are slim to none. And yet, that is the most likely symptom that will make a parent keep their kid home. 58% vomiting once without showing any other symptom will keep their kid at home, which still seems kind of low to me.
Well, I can tell you that my daughter, kindergarten through seventh grade, when she had anxiety, would make herself vomit once every single morning. And I would say that it's not a virus. You need to send her to school once she's feeling a little bit better. And the ex-wife, I'd come home at lunchtime and she would be home. And the kid was perfectly fine. So, that's another poor reason. If a kid wakes up in the morning, coughs three times because he's got post-nasal drip and he gags on his phlegm and pukes, but only phlegm comes up. Well, now he's not going to cough on his phlegm the rest of the day. He sounds a lot better. He's not coughing as much, and he should go to school.
Yeah.
Vomiting that is due to a stomach bug is infectious vomiting. You can pass that on to other people, but vomiting after you cough a bunch of times or vomiting because you have reflux or vomiting because you have anxiety and you have too much acid in your stomach in the morning, those are all reasons that they shouldn't stay home.
49% say a slight fever, which is 10% lower.
Where is the number one reason they keep their kid home is fever?
Yeah,
that should be the number one
reason. Right, not diarrhea, right?
That's right. I don't even see fever on the list. Slight fever.
Yeah,
number one should be fever.
Red watery eyes is 16%. A runny nose, dry cough, and no fever is 12% will keep their kid home.
What is it there? 88% of the people are doing a good job. That means they're sending them with watery eyes, runny nose, cough, and no fever. That's good.
Right. And then lastly, parents also indicated that their own responsibilities played a factor in the decision-making process. 18%.
Oh, big factor.
Yeah. 18% of those polled said not being able to find someone to stay home with their sick child was a very important factor, while 11% said not wanting to miss work was considered very important. Like, just not wanting. Like, for instance,
sick child and unexpected snow days, that eats into the summer vacation time for working parents.
Yep. And that's the thing is, my job currently, there is nobody else at the station at this time who can do my job for me. Right. So that's kind of why I put it out to my wife where I said, hey, I got to be there. But the good news is I get off early enough in your workday that you could still get a pretty solid work day in, not a full one, but you'll be there before lunch, maybe there for an hour or two, then take a lunch and then be able to go, or maybe work through your lunch because you're going in late. That's up to you.
I will say, Justin, that I've been in practice 24 years. I have only missed a handful of days I was scheduled to work because of illness. Once was when I had mono, okay? I was out for a week and a half with mono, all right? Another time I had gone to the hospital as usual, but on my way back from the hospital to the office, I was on the side of Interstate 84 puking and having a fever, and then I shit my pants. I stayed home that day. Hmm. And then the third time was probably more vomiting related to hangover than anything else. But I would say those three instances, probably the only three illnesses that I have had to stay home from work for in my adult life.
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I think, and I honestly don't buy that, and I keep giving them way a lot of credit maybe, but I think the people especially that are listening to this show, I think most of them are kind of like of all the same kind of mindset, and that you just kind of, it's rough and it sucks in a lot of ways, but you had a kid. And sometimes right. You got to stay at home. And as much as we may think, and I don't know what everybody does for a living, but as much as we may think that our job is supremely important, I don't know. I haven't seen a boss who's like, I'm going to shit can you because you were taking care of your sick kid. And
right. And you can't. I mean, now I'll just jump in for a second. One of my nurses, a valuable cog in the machine that runs as Sute and Stewart Pediatrics, she had a baby back in October, and she's coming back, oh God, I think it's February 13th or something like that, and she's been out for 4 months because she can be out for 4 months. The state allows her to do that, and I have to hold that job for her when she comes back. So, you know, obviously 4 months is a long time, and I had to hire another nurse in the interim, but I had to get rid of another one. So this one is going to have to, you know, you have to hold that job for them, but they provide nothing. You know, you don't have to pay her, but she has to be able to come back right. to the same job with the same hours after 4 months.
So you could bring in a temp. You just can't replace right. her.
That's exactly yeah. right. So, and that's tough to do. Her position is given advice, and, you know, it takes a lot for me to, you know, trust someone to give my patients advice when it isn't me giving advice. So it takes a while to, you know, to work into that position. It's not a position a nurse who's never given pediatric telephone advice, you know, could come and do as a temp. So it's tough, but that's the law in Connecticut.
Those over-the-phone nurses are the best thing. I don't know how long those have been around, but as a parent, especially a new parent, those are the
best. Well, I can tell you that nobody out this way had an advice nurse until I did in 1993. So then it became a norm. I was also the first to hire a pediatric nurse practitioner in private practice out my way. I'm a trendsetter. I know what
you're setting trends with peanut allergies, with on-call nurses to ask questions, nurse practitioners. You're killing it, Dr. J. It's basically. Yeah.
I also have been called many times to consult because I have had horrible breakups with my first partner. So when people want to leave their partner, other pediatricians, they'll call and consult with me about how to do it. So awesome. I'm a pioneer in that respect as well.
That's awesome. Okay. What I also want to talk to you about is the whole, this like kind of what we've hinted at. So now we've got all the information from this article, and I just kind of want to ask some questions and pick your brain right after this. All right, we are back with Dr. J, and so we went through all of these things, reasons to keep the reasons parents. Now, these are not doctors, obviously. These are just parents right. looking at their kid going, I don't want to, but I'm gonna keep my kid at home anyway. Let's get from an actual source, Dr. J, give me some solid kind of litmus tests that I could use when deciding should my kid go to school or should they stay home.
All right. Number one on the list is if your kid has a fever. And what is a fever? Unfortunately, my definition is not the same as what a school's definition would be when they send kids home. But anything from 97.5 to 100.5 can be the normal temperature, depending on the kid and depending on the time of day you take the temperature. So to me, it would have to be – you hear the dog.
Yeah, I can hear the squeaking.
Background now. It's hilarious. He was good for, what, 20 minutes?
Yep.
So anything over 100.5 is a fever, Okay, by whichever way you take the temperature, you know, if it's over 100.5, your kid's got a fever. If your kid has had shaking chills, okay, chills, the, you know, shaking, that's how the body relaxes and contracts muscles quickly to release energy, and that's how your body generates a fever. So if you have shaking chills and then a fever, you got a fever. You stay home, and you should not go back to school until you haven't had a fever for 24 hours, all right? If you give Tylenol or Motrin, it'll make the fever go down, but that's just treating the fever. It's not treating the illness. They're not getting any better, and you got to give it again in 4 to 6 hours, or their fever's going to come back. So having a fever early in the morning or overnight, definitely stay home that day, because you will be infectious to other people. The kids will get worse as the school day goes on. And then because they didn't get the rest and the fluids by staying home, it's going to take longer to get them better. That's an easy call right there. Well, that's one.
I want to pick your brain even on fever, because it seems to be like such a big one, is that let's say the kid has what they would – I would qualify maybe then a slight fever as being 1.5 or below, right?
100.5. The schools use 99.9 as a cutoff.
Oh, wow. 0.2 degrees and you're out.
Which is – it's a fucking low-grade fever that I wouldn't even consider a fever.
Well, so I've had nurses. As a parent, I've seen a kid, my son, maybe have a 99 fever. And it here's the thing. I'm not doing rectal. I go with the ear thermometer. I'm pretty sure that's good enough. So maybe it's an inaccurate thing. But I've noticed sometimes if it's like 99.9 or even tipping into 100, that my kid could look like he's just not feeling good. He's not obviously really, really bad, but he's just kind of like, I don't feel good. And I'll give him the Advil. But I've had the nurse that I talked to say, you know, unless it gets above that, don't give him the Advil, because the fever is what is being used to fend off the infection. How say you, doctor?
Yeah, but you don't – well, sometimes kids are at their best behavior when they're 103 degrees.
Yep.
So if that's the case and they're nice and they're cuddly and they're not screaming at you and not asking for something and they're just, you know, comfortably lying in your lap like you
– not miserable.
Dreamed about before you had children.
Yes.
You let that fever go on a little longer. That's all. Cuddle up in a blanket. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh.
No, I think if the kid is showing symptoms, meaning they have headache or body aches and pains – there's no reason not to give the child some Advil simply for those symptoms. And then, you know, if you see the kid getting the shaking chills, you know that a fever is coming. Oh. And who wants to have the shaking chills, be under blankets, take a Tylenol, and then 30 minutes later you're sweating your ass off, kicking off the blankets, and you sweat through your pajamas. I mean, you can prevent the ups and downs of the temperature by giving the Advil.
Okay. So it is – it's fine to, because I've noticed, but here's the thing, it's like what you're describing with a lot of parents in your experience, is that I've noticed I could give the kid the Tylenol or the Advil and then he just perks up. And right. Maybe he's not running, you know, wind sprints in the backyard.
I always say that's the Advil talking.
Yes. And that's the thing where I'll say, so now I've got the fever, so now we know we could give him the Advil. And if they've got a fever, 1.5 or 100.5, I keep saying 1.5, 100.5 and above 100.5, excuse
right.
me. He's got the fever. I pop in some Advil. Then the diagnosis would be, or the suggestion, prescription, whatever, would be to just hang out, watch some TV, drink lots of water or clear juice. Yeah.
Yeah, and as long as they should perk up, you know, within 45 minutes to an hour after getting some Advil. If the kid doesn't perk up, you know, then that might even be a reason to give the doctor's office a call. Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes around this time of year. Out my way, we have a respiratory thing called RSV, and it goes, you know, for little babies under 2, under 18 months, it goes right to their lung and causes them to be breathing 70, 80 times a minute, wheezing, low oxygen, and it can be a cold for a day and a half, and then by the second or third day, their head fills up with snot and they can't breathe. So it's a, you know, and it can turn like in an instant. And, you know, I can't tell you how many of those kids scare the heck out of you. I mean, I saw one right at the end of the day on Friday, and I took the phone number home with me. I called them on Saturday just to make sure they were doing better because I wasn't on call last weekend. But, you know, things can turn in an instant. And as long as they know this, you know, part of the thing is not just say this is what's going on. You say this is what I expect the course to be. And if it's any different than that, you know, call me back, or if it's on off hours, call me back and we'll send you over to the emergency room, but things can change quick. Croup can, you know, be minor at some point, and then, you know, they're gasping for air 20 minutes later. So, you know, and that's the hard part is, you know, I'm not even talking to the patient who's trying to describe their symptoms to me. I'm talking to the parent who's observing the symptoms,
yeah,
who may or may not want to, you know, get out of bed and go to the emergency room at 2 a.m. So it's, I'll tell you, it's not easy. It really is not easy to think on your feet 22 times a day and get it right.
And nail it. Yeah. And that was my other question, was that RSV and croup are the same thing, right? RSV.
No, two different things. Croup is inflammation around the voice box, so they get that barky cough. Parents who get it get laryngitis because their vocal cord area gets swollen, and then RSV goes right down to the lungs and causes a bronchiolitis and can cause secondary pneumonia, and it's a terrible. I mean, even the virus itself can cause babies to stop breathing.
Wow,
it's a nasty thing, and I'm sure it's you know, nationwide, but the Northeast really gets hammered with it November through April, and babies that are born prematurely or, you know, required oxygen when they were born and, you know, were sick babies, there's a vaccine for it, but it's a very expensive vaccine. It's about $1,500, and you have to get one dose each month during the season. So it's usually 6 times $1,500 that the insurance company has to spring for. But it's a very select bunch of kids that get that.
Wow.
So that's been helpful at preventing it. Because when I was a resident, you know, 90 to 93, that was probably the main reason babies were admitted back to the hospital, you know, under the age of 18 months was because of bronchiolitis and RSV. And we didn't have anything to do except stick them in a mist tent and give them some albuterol to open up their lungs a little bit and pray.
Yep. You know? One of the best tips I got from my mom, who was a respiratory therapist before she retired, is that she said anytime, especially when they're little, because you have that first, I think it's not like 4 or 5 years that you can't really give them a decongestant for, over
right,
the counter.
Now it's up to 4, yeah.
Yeah. So
it used to be 6 months when I started.
Man,
but
I wish
they
I
took away the little liquid Sudafed because it's one step closer to meth than crushing up the pills.
Right. So she said just keep the airway clear. And so both my wife and I kind of became adamant, not even when the kid was sick, but just anytime we were changing a diaper, we checked to make sure and suck out any boogers that could be in there.
Yep.
And I really think it helped us avoid a lot of those colds and congestion because the kid
have
can't
you
blow
the
their
tubes
nose.
They have now. Now
no.
They have you stick a tube up the kid's nose. There's a little trap in the middle, and you suck with your own suck at the other end of the tube, and the snot gets sucked into the little trap.
Oh, I'll stick with the bulb. I guess. Well, I guess the bulb is harder to clean. Is that their point?
But you know what? People, they don't know they're supposed to squeeze the bulb first, then stick it in the kid's nostril to suck the snot out. A lot of them are squeezing it, and they're shooting that snot right up to the kid's frontal lobe, and that's probably not good.
Well, what started my whole relationship with you, I don't know if you remember, but I'd literally gone on the road with you, or I got on the road and met you, and a friend of mine was dealing with a sick kid like the week before or maybe even the same weekend, and she had seen on a mom blog that you should only use that sucker 3 times a day, and I was trying to like rationalize. Yeah, so I was like, well, and my wife tried to explain it to her and say, well, if you were sick, would you just blow your nose 3 times a day? Because that's all you're doing. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So we got through the fever. What would you say would be the next step to kind of say this is a symptom that kid needs to stay home?
All right. Well, just to finish with the fever, they should wait a full 24 hours after they're on antibiotics if it turns out to be something bacterial like strep throat or an ear infection or, you know, bronchitis, 24 hours after antibiotics, even if the symptoms are still there, the fever usually is gone once you put them on something. But if the symptoms are still there and they've been on antibiotics for 24 hours, they're not contagious and they can go back to school. Ear infections aren't contagious at all, because they're caused by bacteria that are normally in the nose and the back of the throat, and they just take advantage of the fact that your eustachian tubes get plugged up, and then they cause an infection on the fluid that gets left behind. And it's a closed system, so none of that bacteria in the ear space is getting out to infect anybody. So the other thing is fever without any kind of Tylenol or Advil has to be gone for 24 hours. So, you know, most things are going to take, if you catch a viral illness, at the very least 3 days, but 5 days. And then, you know, the flu and mono take 7 to 10 days. But, you know, most are going to take at least 3 days and sometimes 5 days. So no way around that. It's just part of life.
Okay. And then, and by symptoms, you could mean like coughing or vomiting.
Kids, but trust me, kids cough from November until April. The parents say they've been coughing for 4 months. I know they've been coughing in 2 week intervals with a 1 or 2 day respite in between those for the last 4 months. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, it's just crap going around. I don't get acutely sick anymore, but I have to live with chronic congestion 365 days a year. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay. It never goes from the baseline, never gets better, never gets worse. I seem to have caught everything that there is out there to catch. Now there's an Ebola vaccine, so I think I'm going to be covered for that too. I think I'm all right.
So cough is good unless you have a fever. Can you send a kid to school with a cough?
No, the fever is the first thing to go. Your kid even whispers to a teacher that they think they don't feel good, and the fever is over 99.9. You're going to get disturbed in the middle of your day, and you're going to have to go pick them up. So don't even bother
taking them there.
Or you pay the kid, give the kid $20 to keep their mouth shut. You got a meeting or whatever. You know, I can't come and pick you up, buddy. Here's $20. Don't say anything about being sick to your teacher or the nurse.
Rub some dirt on
deal?
It.
Yeah. Deal?
Yeah.
You know? And then the kid shivering in a corner having a febrile seizure.
You already said,
but he's got a $20 bill in his pocket.
You already said diarrhea is not necessarily a reason. And yeah, obviously
pink eye, very contagious.
Yeah.
Right. You show up at school with draining eyes that are pink. They're going to turn you right around. Don't even try it.
How do you? Yeah, exactly. Because my wife has run into this where she kept saying that my son had pink eye. And I was like, I think he just had his eye was a little irritated, because I feel like each of my sons
has got to be red or injected red pink eyes with greenish yellow stuff that doesn't come out of the eyes just once in the morning, like when you wake up with sleep in your eyes.
Right.
It continues. You clean it away, and 20 minutes later, it accumulated again.
Yeah.
That's pink eye. And if you have pink eye combined with cold symptoms, runny nose and cough, and you're under 5, half of those kids are also going to have ear infections. So at that point, you've already made the decision. He's got goop coming out of his eyes. I'm not going to he's not going to school today. And there's a 50-50 chance he could be developing an ear infection. So you take the day off and you call the pediatrician's office and you make an appointment.
So, and you already said too, the vomiting, if they vomit, but there's no other symptoms, like a vomit from anxiety.
Vomiting once is nothing, but stomach bugs, you vomit until everything is out of your stomach, until you're done with you've got the drive heaves at the end. It's not once and done when you have a stomach bug, because your body's trying to get the virus out of your body. So it tries to eject it from above. And then the last 2 days with diarrhea is trying to get the rest of it out from below.
Mm. So it's literally just expunging the system.
Yeah. And you want to have those glove for the diarrhea or any kind of colon clean out for a colonoscopy. You want to get those shittens, those gloves wipe your ass, because it's not pretty.
Yeah, it's like
have you seen them? They're shittens, called.
I haven't seen the gloves, but I did hear a recommendation when you're getting a colonoscopy to get wipes as opposed to using toilet paper when they make you flush your system out before you go to the colonoscopy, because you will kind of rub yourself raw. Is that what you're kind of describing?
Yes, and you have no idea how much the health service industry has liked the shittens, because those Jamaican home care nurses that have to clean the elderly, they would like them to run all the way up to their elbow.
Wow. All right, so I think we've covered everything as far as symptoms where you should keep your kid home or send them to school, right?
Yeah, diarrhea without a fever at the end of a stomach bug. You know, if the kid's worried he's going to shit his pants at school, I guess you got to keep him home. But other than that, that's not hurting anybody. Kids who, you know, have a little too much milk and have loose poops because of lactose stuff, or kids who drink juices, or kids who chew a lot of sugarless gum. The sugars in sugarless gum don't get digested. They go into your GI tract and cause you to have loose poops too. All of those are not reasons to stay home.
Oh, all right. So here's the thing. I get the hanging out with friends, and people will say, well, he's coughing, right? Or she's coughing, but there's no fever, so therefore they're not contagious.
Right.
Is that
or
true?
Or if they've been on an antibiotic for a couple of days, they're just now clearing out all of the, you know, non-infectious stuff.
Okay, so what if it's a cough, but there's like, you could see, especially on little ones, you could see just like a green, what looks like you're entering a cavern of some kind with stalactites and stalagmites around the nostrils?
I see those kids too. If a kid wakes up and has green snot and you clear it away and the rest of the day it runs clear, it's just because that clear snot sat in his nasal cavity all night and became green snot. But if you have copious amounts of green, yellow stuff that is coming out of your head all day long consistently, yeah, that could be a sinus infection. It could be that things have backed up, so you want to take a look in the ears too. But that doesn't happen immediately with kids. With adults, you can go from, I think I have a sniffle, to having a full-blown sinus infection in 24 hours. But kids, it doesn't happen that way. You know, things might run a little green the first couple days if there's no fever or ear pain. And then, you know, after 5 days of cold symptoms, things should be wrapping up. And at that point, things start to get thick and chunky. Older kids will complain that they have, you know, the upper teeth hurt, or they have a headache in their forehead. Well, yeah, things can back up and they can get sinus infection. So, you know, green in the first 3 to 5 days for kids does not mean all that much. My feeling is kids have a cold. I tell all the parents in my practice, it's a cold until one of three things happens, okay? One, they get goopy eyes. If they're under five, half of the kid with goopy eyes are going to have ear infections, so they should come in. The second thing is if they have cold symptoms and develop a fever, because a lot of kids will have runny nose, cough, couple of days, no fever, and then they get a fever on the fourth day of symptoms. That makes me think something settled somewhere, so they should be looked at. And the last thing is not sleeping at night with Motrin or Advil on board, because kids who are teething will sleep great for 6 hours if they have Motrin or Advil on board. But kids with an ear infection, it doesn't take care of that kind of pain. And every time they yawn, every time they swallow, every time they turn over on their pillow, it hurts and they do not sleep well. So not sleeping well, goopy eyes, new fever during a cold, all of those things kind of say, okay, now it's time to go see the doctor.
So if there's no fever and you got the green and yellow discharge, not a reason to go see the doctor or anything to panic
not
about.
Necessarily, unless it's been going on for an extended period of time, you know, more than, you know, 7 to 10 days.
Okay. But it is enough of a reason to say if you had a party or a play date that you should cancel for the sake of just not extending it on to the other family.
I guess. If they don't have a fever, I'm not too worried about
it. Oh, okay.
I mean, there's always that one snotty-nosed kid with the one draining eye in every play group.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. I'm just trying to get a barometer.
Elementary school and use the water fountain.
Exactly.
But I digress.
But my barometer being like, I didn't know until this conversation with you that if there's a kid coughing and, you know, and everything looks clear that's coming out of their nose, then there's nothing to worry about, really.
Just body getting rid of secretions. Right. That's all.
But I was just curious, if I see like green or yellow, then maybe
kid hawks up a phlegm ball that's yellowish green. Well, yeah, then you're talking there's something going on down there. But, you know, most of the time the kids come in, I say, are you coughing anything up? And they just tell me, you know, clear spit or just clear sputum. You know, very, very few times, you know, are kids hawking up green loogies. And girls, they don't look. Boys always like to, yeah, you know, with their nose blow and show. But girls, they never look at secretions.
That's true. All right. We got an email that I want to go over with you next. Okay.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I got everything on that subject.
Yeah, hit me if there's anything you see on yours. You're good?
Yeah, just know what your school's cutoff is for fever, and don't try any fast ones.
Yeah, it's just a waste of everybody's time. It's true.
And thank God for water fountains and ChapStick, because that's what keeps my my revenue stream going.
Okay, so we got an email from a listener that is really, really interesting and has a lot of...
He's in the midst of a shitstorm.
Yes, exactly. So I'm just going to read the whole thing real quick, just so the listeners have kind of a reference. But it says, first off, I want to say that my son is seeing an MFT, and we've talked with his pediatrician quite a bit, but this problem has persisted for over 2 years, and a second opinion would be nice. What is an MFT, Doc? Do you know that term? Okay. It's,
probably like a family therapist.
Oh, marriage therapist. And family therapist, I bet.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Okay. How old did, did you get to the part with how old the kid is again?
I have a that's the next part. I have a four-year-old son who has been urine potty trained for 2 years, but poops in his pants daily, six times so far today, and it's only 2 p.m. He is withholding, but we've tweaked his diet so it comes out. He has bad constipation for at least a year because of bananas and dairy, both of which are now very limited or cut out altogether. When he was two, he was using the potty to poop some of the time, but then his baby brother came along and he regressed, which I know is very common, but it's been a year now. He was starting to stop withholding and poop on the bathroom floor and clean up after himself. Recently, my mom died of cancer only 3 weeks after diagnosis. She would play with my son while I did chores 2 to 3 days a week, so they were very close. Since her death, there's been another big regression, and he started withholding again. The poop gets compacted, and then he smears his pants over and over all day long. Graham crackers and water, thanks to Dr. J, seem to help. Our marriage and family therapist says just not to talk about it and be patient. If it continues, he may get kicked out of preschool. Sorry for the long email, but wanted to include as much info as possible. So break that down for us. What do you think is going on here, and what can they do?
Well, it sounds like he is able and capable of, you know, recognizing when he has to go, because, you know, he's going in and crapping on the bathroom floor.
And then cleaning it up, too.
And then cleaning it up. But it does sound like kids who are constipated for a long period of time, I think he said it was like a year of constipation, their colon is like a big deflated balloon. It's not doing anything. It's been packed with stool for so long, it hasn't helped the stool get pushed out of the body in a year, probably.
So it's like an astronaut in space. It just kind of emaciates.
It's not helpful to pushing things along. So the stool just sits in there. And what happens is you have to do whatever you have to do to get the kid to be stooling normally. And you can't just – it's not an overnight deal. I mean, you give kid a laxative, he shits the next day. You're not done, because something, his diet or whatever, was leading up to, you know, whatever happened there. So you have to find whatever regimen of, you know, diet, and I'll tell you in a second what helps, and fiber and fluid that's going to make the kid have a soft bowel movement. Doesn't even have to go every day, but when he goes, he has to have something that's no more thick than peanut butter, at least every couple of days, regularly for a month before you stop anything, okay? That's the biggest problem, is the kid poops twice in a row and it's normal. They stop doing what got them to normal, and the kid's colon is still this big deflated balloon, and it needs to restore its elasticity so that it'll eventually be able to push things along again. So you have to have them pooping normally for at least a month so that the colon can become more helpful at pushing it out. The other thing is, kids who hoard associate having a poop with pain and discomfort, and it could be pain from the crampy belly leading up to them having to go, or pain from pushing out a big one and they, you know, split the anal area and get a little bloody fissure there, and then it takes a couple days for them to heal, and that kid says, well, that really sucked, I'm never going to do that again. So they hold on to it because it hurts. So part of it is, you know, diet, part of it is pain. So they have to have normal poops for a month so they forget that the poop ever hurt too. So those two things are why you can't cure constipation overnight, and there's not like a pill to give, make them go, and life goes on. So the things I always tell them to do is whatever amount of fluids they're doing in terms of fruit juices. If they're not doing any fruit juices, at least 8 ounces of diluted apple or pear juices. If you're desperate, prune, but you want to dilute that at least 25%, because that's like liquid dynamite right there. That'll clear out a kid. For bigger kids, we use Miralax a lot, which is a fiber laxative. And for kids that are impacted, that have you feel just like a big freaking football in their belly, the recipe is usually six capfuls of Miralax in one of those big 32-ounce Gatorade bottles, and mix it with the Gatorade and down that, and that will clear you out. In fact, they use something similar to that to clean out adults for colonoscopies now too. So that will get them a clean palate, so to speak. And then they can start with the dietary things, which are, you know, the things that they should be eating. All the pea fruits, peaches, pears, prunes, plums, apricots, those type of things, green beans, green vegetables, you know, the salad stuff, lettuce, cucumbers, carrots, those things all are carrots. If you eat them raw, help you go. Carrots, if you cook them, constipate you. Apple juice helps you go, but apples and applesauce constipate you. I don't need to go into why, but just trust me, it's true. And every kid loves apples and bananas and cereal and squash and sweet potatoes and cooked carrots. And that's why those are their favorites, and they get backed up. So diet has to change, more fluids, better foods and fruits in there that are less constipating, like dairy and junk food, and white rice can be substituted with brown rice, and, you know, white bread with wheat bread and that kind of stuff. Graham crackers with fluids, as the listener mentioned, is good too.
So, but wait,
the fluid,
white bread,
the fiber, and changing the diet a little bit, and using Miralax, because kids don't eat the foods that are helpful at pooping. So if your back's against the wall, Miralax mixes beautifully with any fluid. It doesn't have taste, it doesn't have texture, and it's all a matter of titrating how much it takes. You know, it might be a capful, might be a half a capful, might be six capsules to blow out a teenager that's backed out or has been failing to spit out his sunflower seed shells and has a big impaction down there of sharp sunflower seed shells. You blow them out, but you got to get a clean palate somehow, get the kid's colon back in shape, and that takes a while to do, at least a month. And then continuing whatever it is that keeps them regular, trying to get rid of maybe the Miralax, but the dietary stuff is what's going to be useful and helpful to them forever. And if you go to the doctor and they give you suggestions, you know, and it's not working, call the doctor back. I mean, constipation is easily taken care of. You know, sometimes if it's not working, all, you know, we use everything we have at our disposal, we'll, you know, send you to a, you know, pediatric gastroenterologist. But those would be for all the medical things. I think this child sounds like there's some behavioral stuff involved with it too. It could be that, you know, now the baby is you know, now a couple years old, and you know, also getting attention. And I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, hoopla and attention and stuff when he craps his pants and shits in the middle of the bathroom, and you know, everybody's running around trying to get stuff done. That's a lot of attention, you know. So I don't know. I would definitely say all the things I mentioned he should try. Next step would be a pediatric gastroenterologist and maybe a behavioral therapist, just to, you know, kind of help the kid along a little bit. Sound like they said they were seeing a marriage family therapist. But stool hoarders usually do it out of pain. That's probably the number one reason. And the reason they're in pain is because they're constipated.
So just so I can kind of make sure that I'm
did
hearing,
I ramble? I'm
no,
sorry if I rambled.
No, it was a ton of great information, but it's not rambling at all. Is that so? What you're coming at this from is a more clinical standpoint, to say physiologically, here are the issues from the time frame that they're discussing, right, and that they're going to have to deal with, and that's kind of what you're approaching. Whereas I think from her standpoint, what she's kind of looking at is that there does seem to be a lot of the behavioral, or for lack of a better way of putting it, psychological
Last time I dealt with this, and this will make the mom and dad there feel a little better, it was with a 9-year-old, and he was smearing stool on the walls next to his bed. And it was completely and utterly behavioral and related to a little bit of oppositional defiance, but also chronic constipation. So, you know, it's something at 4. I mean, my goal with every kid that comes to my office is not shitting in their pants by kindergarten. That's housebroken by kindergarten. That's my rule.
So at 4, it's still not – it's not crazy, you know what I mean, or excessive in any way, shape, or form.
I mean, I've had a couple kids, you know, last week of August is coming and – time is bearing down on them, but we've always accomplished our mission.
But like you discussed, is that it is more psychological than physiological.
I mean, if he's having hard poops, they got to take care of that first and make it so that the poops don't hurt and he's pooping normally before any kind of behavioral training is going to work.
Because
so
if you can't, if he's uncomfortable, then you can't even get through the next level to make it to where he just goes in and goes to the bathroom.
Right.
Gotcha. Right. All right. Well, that was our show.
And I'd love some follow-up, you know, from these guys. If any of the suggestions helped, I'd love to – next time I come on, if they want to send back an email to you and, you know, give us a little follow-up and see if I can have to tweak anything.
Yeah, if you want to send those to questions at thedadpodcast.com, that's my email account that I usually set aside – or that I set aside for Rachel and Dr. J. But you can also use show at thedadpodcast.com. I get all of those too. So thank you again, Dr. J, for the wealth of knowledge. This was a big one. This was a lot to tackle in one episode. And in my humble opinion, you crushed it, sir.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I look at the clock and I say, oh, how the hell am I going to talk about this for an hour?
I do the same.
You always keep me going. It's great. I enjoy it. Thanks very much for having me again.
No problem. Again, you can find out if Dr. J is performing stand-up comedy in your area by going to standuppediatrician.com. Follow him on the Twitter at Dr. J Sute. The spelling for all of that is in the description of this episode. Give us a like at facebook.com/dadpodcast. You can also, if you are new to the show and haven't heard me talk about this already a million times, you should check out the fan group. It's Staying Frosty with the Dad Podcast on Facebook, run by our very own Butcher Drew.
All right.
And it's a great place that you can talk to other like-minded parents, and they share fun moments of the week and just all around fun stories and hilarious memes. I saw one over there the other day that a mom posted that she said, I'm just a girl sitting across from a boy telling him to stop playing with his penis and sit right.
There you go.
Which really, because we're dealing a lot, or my wife, I should say, my wife is dealing a lot with the kind of scratching and then the sniffing. The sniffing is what's really driving her nuts, is that...
hand down the pants, scratch a little bit, take a whiff. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. He's going full blown orangutan on her. And it's,
the
I
sad
never,
part is they touch it and it feels good. Yep. So the feedback loop is to keep touching it.
Exactly. And keep sniffing. So definitely check that out. Don't forget to go to thedadpodcast.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, click on that Amazon banner, make that bookmark it as your Amazon link. And every time you go to Amazon, Daddy gets a little taste. It costs you nothing. All it does is take a little percentage and they throw it my way for sending Amazon traffic. It's the weirdest thing in the world. The one place that doesn't need advertising, at least at this point, but that's what they
do. Damn, I shouldn't have bought that MacBook Pro yesterday without knowing that. Damn.
I'm sorry. It's all right. No big deal. It's nice, fun, surprise mailbox money. That's always the way I see it. But thank you again to Dr. J. On behalf of Dr. J, this is Justin Worship saying hug your kids, hump your loved one, and stay frosty, my friends.